You're listening easy to Smooth Sailing with your captain, Jason Scanberg, only on WJEV Radio, Milwaukee's finest classic country music, with special guest,
Matt. Smooth Sailing on WJEB Radio 101.1 FM. Today on Smooth Sailing, on this very not snowy Milwaukee day, but soon to be apparently, we will be having Mr. Matt Kay on. Matt, are you here? Oh, I see he is unmuted. Can I hear him?
Am I coming through all right?
Yes, you're coming through great.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. And I just want to say, if you're out there driving or doing anything tonight, be careful, because apparently snow is going to be coming down pretty hard in the next couple hours. So good driving to anyone out there. We're sailing out there. So, Matt, we haven't talked much before this podcast, and like many of my other previous people, previous interviewees that I've had on. So, you've told me that you are in ROTC, but I just wanted to get a few more questions in before that. So, what is your major, and what year are you at MSOE?
So I am brand new at MSOE. I am a freshman, computer engineering, so lots of fun, first semester. Well, now we're in the, not really in semesters, now we're in the second quarter, so it's going pretty well so far.
No difficulties, everything's coming along fine?
Yeah, you know, the first couple laps have you stumbling, and then you kind of, you know, catch your stride after that. So, but they're really fun and exciting, and you feel like you're actually doing something, which I think helps a lot.
Have you happened to run into Dr. Russ Meyer yet?
Yes, I have met Dr. Meyer. He's an absolute treasure. Love talking to him whenever I do get to see him.
Yes, he He's on our website. He is a proud listener of WJEV Radio himself. I love Dr. Meyer. Maybe we'll have him on one day. Hint.
That'd be awesome.
Anyway, back to what I was saying before. So before you came on, you did tell me that you were in the you were in ROTC, specifically in the Air Force branch of ROTC. Would you mind just giving an overview of what ROTC is across many universities in the country?
Yeah, of course. So I can't comment too much on the other branches because ROTC really differs pretty heavily depending on what branch you go into. We all have our different ways of training student cadets into future leaders in the U.S. Armed Forces. But I'll say for the Air Force, many universities, especially if they're public, have one. MSOE does not specifically have a detachment or like a unit. Each university has a detachment that participates in the program. We have a crosstown agreement with Marquette University, and so do a lot of other universities, where we will Marquette has agreed to take students from other universities, and so technically I am also a Marquette student, even though I don't go there for like my major. I go there for Air Force classes. So that makes it so not every school has to have their own detachment in order for students to go through that career path of being an officer in the armed services. So I commute to Marquette on like a weekly basis, and but we're not resuming until later because Marquette's on a whole different schedule from our university. So,
and has quarantine and the recent rise in COVID complicated any of that cross-town traveling with your Air Force classes?
Well, the Department of Defense has taken a pretty solid stance on the situation. They are requiring vaccinations. Marquette is now requiring booster shots as well in order to go back. They actually extended the class day, like the day that classes are resuming back from break, just so people could go get their boosters. So a lot of our policies are guided by what Marquette thinks. The only military-related one is that everyone's got to be vaccinated. And we do wear masks whenever we are inside as well. But other than that, it's a pretty casual environment. We are around each other a lot, but as soon as anyone has any signs of being sick or anything like that, we have precautions in place to make sure that they don't get other cadets sick.
So after you're done with your classes and your training as a cadet, then what happens?
So there's a couple of phases that you go through. So as a freshman right now, I'm in the general military course, and that is like learning how to be a member of the military, how to have proper bearing, how to wear the uniform, what jobs there are in the Air Force, and that like starts getting cadets thinking about, hey, you know, what do I actually want to do in the Air Force if they haven't already thought about that? And then you go through field training. So field training, happens between the summer, between your sophomore year and your junior year. And that is kind of like the weed out sort of thing. It kind of sounds bad to say that, but it is. It's pretty much a military basic training. If you've ever seen a Full Metal Jacket or anything like that, it's not as intense because it's the Air Force. We're not the Marines. But that's where all the boot camp-esque stuff happens. And then once you pass that, you go into the professional officer course. That's kind of the leadership position. You've been taught everything, and now you're expected to learn leadership abilities so you can go become an officer when you graduate. And so professional officer course, cadets are upperclassmen, and they're there as like mentors and stuff.
If you don't mind me asking, if you even know, how does the Department of Defense choose which schools have an ROTC tie? So I don't know if UW-Milwaukee has an ROTC program on their own or if they're also partnered with Marquette.
Yeah, so all of the Milwaukee area schools, like pretty much any like school that's in or even around the Milwaukee area. Like we have cadets that come all the way, that commute all the way from like Kenosha, that'll come up. And they make the trek every time, and I've got mad respect for them doing that, because that doesn't sound easy to me. But UW-Milwaukee is a partner school. It's all headquartered in Marquette, so any school that exists within that metropolitan area is, yeah, they feed into Marquette. So I think that the way it's decided, like if a school has a program, I'm not too certain on this, but I know that if a school receives public funding or grants of some sort, then they have to be open to it. And there's like been big cases about, there's been protests and stuff about should schools let, you know, the military have a presence on their campus, and should the government force them to have those programs if they receive public funding. And that's a whole different, you know, complicated issue in and of itself that I have no idea how to even tackle. So, but I'm pretty sure that's how the process works.
Okay. I was just thinking it was a bit odd that we have a UW-Milwaukee is a pretty large school, and it's a public school. So why wouldn't the U.S. government just choose that school over Marquette? But like you said, I do realize that both, well, almost every school in the nation receives public funding. So it is eligible. And I did not know about that. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's kind of complicated. I don't know too much about like how they choose which school gets a detachment or not.
So do you know of any parts of the nation that don't have ROTC implemented, or is it pretty nationally like solid? Like there is no region in the country where, like, let's say you went to, I don't know. So we're in southeast Wisconsin. Let's say you went to northwest Wisconsin. Is there 100% always going to be a university or detachment you can potentially do in a certain part where you live or around where you live? Or is it just around major hubs, like, let's say, Milwaukee or Chicago?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not too certain on how other states work. I do know that if there is a big university, there's a very, very high chance that there is an ROTC detachment there. I want to say, so I know that in Wisconsin, we only have two. There's Detachment 930, which is at Marquette. That's Milwaukee. And then there is Detachment 925, which is our sister detachment in Madison. So I feel like if you went over into western Wisconsin, you would be more pushed towards Madison, but I don't know how many feeder schools they have. But it is pretty rare that you find a school where ROTC isn't offered. If you are curious or you want to look it up, if you go on AirForceROTC.com, or I think it's AFROTC.com, they have like an entire map where they have every single college and partner school that has it as an available program. And there's dots just everywhere across the map. So
I'm just a bit confused. When you say Air Force detachment, are there certain ROTC programs which, let's say, have a Marine and Army detachment but no Air Force detachment in specific offered?
I don't think I've ever heard of a school that only offers like one branch or two branches. Usually if there is an Air Force ROTC detachment at a school, there are also the other branches there as well, because that school qualifies to have a detachment there, and so all the branches want to have a presence on campus because they're all looking to recruit. So like I know that MSOE, I've met Army ROTC cadets, I've met Navy guys, midshipmen I think is what the Navy calls their cadets, and you can see them around campus. They're either wearing camo, or I think the Navy has like a khaki uniform, but I know that Marquette for certain has all the branches, and I don't imagine it why a school would only have one or two.
On that note, why the Air Force? What made you choose that?
Because I just like the fact that it's the most technologically advanced branch, in my opinion. We do the most research and development. And also, yes, the Space Force is also the branch that I want to go into. The Air Force is the path to get there, though. That's like the sister branch, kind of how the Navy and the Marines are intertwined with one another. If you want to become a Marine officer, you have to go through Navy ROTC. The same applies with the Space Force. So I specifically would like to be a developmental engineer to work on all the secret classified Department of Defense projects that the public doesn't want, that shouldn't know about. Like, it's kind of sad that in order, I'm sorry, were you wanting to say something?
Oh, no. Continue on. I'll ask the question afterwards.
Okay. I think it's kind of sad that in order for us to put more money into space, it always has to be for a defense-related reason. But that's pretty much how it's going to happen, in my opinion, is if we want to put more money into space, we need to give the government a good reason. And the government loves weapons. And so, you know, I'd still want to be a part of space innovation, even if it means developing something that may or may not harm someone in the future. Hopefully not. Using weapons on people, but yeah.
So isn't it possible that there are other paths where you could also develop weapons? So I don't know much about how the Department of Defense develops classified weapons, but I'm also familiar that I believe the Energy Department also has some say in what is specifically, how do I put this? The Energy Department is very much tied to the development of classified weapons as well, correct?
I don't know. Do you mean by Energy Department like infrastructure?
The Department of Energy of the United States.
I'm not too sure about that because I've never looked into those programs before. So the way it works in the Department of Defense is we partner with a lot of the big name companies like Boeing, Lockheed Martin, all those things. But in terms of like the overall systems engineering of like we need these requirements to go into this weapon system. And we send developmental engineers that are officers in the Air Force to work and oversee the work done by Lockheed and Boeing and all those other people. So it's more like you go right into an engineering management position and you get to toy around with all the fun technology, but you're more in a supervisory role.
I see. And how were you introduced to this position? How did you learn that it existed in the first place?
So before I wanted to go into the ROTC, I wanted to make sure I could do engineering because that was my primary goal. And I found it on the Air Force's career website. And then when I actually got into the program, as part of our Air Force class, because we are enrolled in those classes at Marquette, as I mentioned before, there's an assignment where we had to do a briefing on a career field that we wanted to go into. And so I did a bunch of research on it and discovered, you know, the day-to-day responsibilities and what goes into a job like that. And I listened. We had a developmental engineer come in and actually talk to our detachment. I think it was a major that came in and spoke to us. But and I like the career field, so I decided, hey, I want to work towards this.
So what specifically enticed you, if you remember back to when you were first researching it? I mean, you've already alluded to it, most of it, which is the actual engineering itself. I suppose what I'm really asking is, why does engineering in general fascinate you? What is it about computer engineering and advanced systems that just sticks out and grabs your attention?
So this is going to sound really weird, and some people might relate to this a lot, but when I was a kid, I still love the Marvel Universe a lot, and I used to idolize Tony Stark and Iron Man, and I thought that the whole super suit thing was, like, really cool, and I wanted to build one myself when I was a kid, and so And I noticed that Iron Man had a best friend who was James Rhodes. You know, I think he's like a colonel in the Air Force in the comics or something like that. And you know, they got to play around with all the technology that Stark Industries developed. And then I was like, you know what? That's kind of analogous to real life, how private companies work together with the government and they create, you know, really cool things. It's not that the weapon is like, you know, I want to use this to, you know, destroy something. It's just like, it's a cool thing. You know, you look at Tony Stark's armor and it's like, man, I wish I could wear that just because it would be awesome. And so that was like the first thing that really tipped me off is like, I want to do something related to electronics and advanced systems. I looked at that as an inspiration. I also played a game when I was little called Section 8. It's like a really obscure indie game about the future and like advanced warfare and whatnot. So video games had a big impact as well.
And so, okay. I'm trying to figure out how to ask this. Okay, so as a supervisor, let's say you make it up the career path, you get into a supervisor position in, let's say, like Lockheed Martin or Boeing or something like that. Would you have a say on what the project you would be developing is, or for the time being, would you essentially receive like something that you've been requested to build and then try and produce it for someone higher up on the chain of command?
So there's two different ways that you can be requested to be assigned to a project. So I mentioned the managerial aspect of being paired with a company and doing the management and supervision of, like, let's say, a prototype or an engineering project. And that is acquisitions work, which is one. There's like so many different parts of the job. Like you can meet one developmental engineer that works purely in acquisitions and does that. And you can also meet an engineer who works in research and development, and they'll have, like, let's say a colonel walk up to them and be like, we want to test this thing in the field. You know, we want like a high powered laser, which is a real thing that they'll ask for, or a real example of something they could ask for. And you just, they're like, here's a bunch of money. You have a team with you of fabrication workers, you know, enlisted personnel who I greatly respect because they can get stuff done. And they're like, go make it. We need it in like 2 weeks. And so that's the more cool aspect. Most engineers do the managerial thing. I don't know too much about, like, a lot of it is classified because you need it, at the very least, a secret security clearance to even work on that stuff. But most of the time they have a top secret security clearance. So it's very foggy because the Air Force a lot of times doesn't tell you like the exact day by day of what you'll be doing, because so much life in the military is just, you're doing this thing one day and then the next day it's completely different and everything's changed. You know, you don't stay in one place for more than 2 years usually. So it's kind of a hard question to answer. I kind of half answered it, I guess. Are we having audio problems? I don't think I can hear you.
You might be taking a call.
Okay.
Because he's a fun fact. Our Captain Jackson Scanberg is a public safety dispatcher for the ship. And he is doing that.
Sorry. I apologize. I had something come up momentarily and I forgot to cut the commercial or even was able to tell you. So.
Oh, no, it's all good.
Post. But yes, everything's classified, so you don't know what the day to day is going to look like necessarily in the future. You know what it's sort of maybe going to look like.
Yeah.
How long does a career last in the military doing developmental work? Like, what's the average length of a military career?
So, when it comes to engineering, after you graduate from college and get your degree and you commission and everything, it's usually a 4-year period that you are required by contract to stay in. A lot of people will leave and they'll go into the private sector. It really depends on the career you're in, but it's a 4-year minimum for that specific job. But if you're going into, let's say, a rated position like a pilot, the Air Force wants to get their money's worth out of you, so they'll usually have you stay on for like about a decade, which is pretty long, but hey, they're investing, you know, millions of dollars into you as one person, so that's the reason why they have that policy.
A single pilot costs millions of dollars? I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, for training, like, total, across the entire lifetime that they're in the service.
I suppose that makes sense, considering, well, just frankly, what they'll be piloting.
Oh, yeah.
Many, many hundreds, if not thousands, if not thousands of times more than $1 million.
Oh, yeah, their helmets alone are like $1 million. Like, just for the fighter pilot helmet that you see that's got, like, the cool, like, eyeglasses on it and everything. They've got, like, super advanced avionics in there. They can peer through the bottom of the plane by looking down. It's insane.
That is kind of insane. Oh, peer through the bottom of the plane by looking down.
Yeah, there's sensors. There's a whole vision system around the aircraft, so they can literally just see out of the steel if they want.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, so now we're going to get back into the second thing that you really want to talk to everyone on this podcast about, which is high-level projects that you may know about. That I may want to ask about. And the first thing I would want to ask if you know anything about is, do you know of any country in the world who has maybe even some of the close technology that we have?
Oh, China for certain.
China for certain.
China is, and I don't want to get political about this, this is a purely threat-based response, just based on how their military technology has been progressing and the technology that they've stolen from us. And I don't want to get political just because I'm in a position where I'm representing the Air Force at the moment and we're not allowed to talk about politics. But from a threat perspective, they have a lot of the technology that we develop. And China is a tricky thing because they are really good at reverse engineering things. Like, for example, the F-22, it's either the F-22 or the F-35. They're both very advanced stealth fighter aircraft. You know, billions of dollars has been poured into the development of the F-35. It's, like, insane. I think it's actually a trillion now that it's up to. It's one of the most expensive projects that's ever been developed. But China made a cheap knockoff version called the J-22 pretty recently. And so I think they're really good at taking our technology, and that's bad because we spend all the time and money to prototype and do the research and development, and we have all these, you know, startup upfront costs, and then they can take all the work and they can manufacture it for cheaper because we've done it for them. And so they have a leg up on us in that department, and they can mass produce things easier. So I'd say that's one big thing. China is also the government is struggling right now with cybersecurity as well. There's been lots of reports by analysts that, you know, we are trying as a nation to become better on that specific warfighting front of cyber warfare. But it's hard for us because one of the big problems is human resources, actually, because in agencies like the CIA or the NSA, they can't hire good computer scientists because drug testing. everyone tests positive for marijuana nowadays. And so they that disqualifies them from all the good programmers out there. Apparently all the good programmers are stoners. So.
That's kind of funny. I've heard that they were, and I don't know if this is true, but I've heard that it's been considered to get rid of that to combat, to help with that front of cyber warfare that's going on. I don't know if anything ever got acted on that, but that was something I heard like a year or two ago.
I think it would be a good policy because one criticism that I do have of a lot of government defense-related jobs or intelligence-related jobs is a lot of times they have a blanket restriction on certain physical things. Like for a lot of cadets, we have to go through the DODMERB process, which is they will comb through every single piece of medical data that's ever been published about you in your entire life. Like they can access all your medical records. And you have the chance to tell them, oh, you know, I have this condition or that condition. It doesn't really matter if you do or don't, because they'll find it anyways. And, you know, even small things like I have braces at the moment. They said, yeah, if you have braces by the time you commission, you're not going to become an officer. And I'm like, wow, I didn't know that that was that important. But so I feel like that's one big thing that the military gets a lot of flack for is that there's a lot of weird restrictions, and some of them are fair because like if you're a pilot, you can't really be colorblind. That makes sense, or you need to have good vision. But it's the small things like, oh, you know, if you have ADHD, if you're taking medication for it, then we can't have you. It doesn't matter how good your grades are. We still classify it as an academic disability. Like that's one big one that DQs a lot of people or disqualifies them. So.
I was considering doing ROTC for quite a while, but I didn't because I was a type 1 diabetic and I was looking at essentially what that DQs me from. And it's a lot of things, even though it's very well maintained and it's almost never a factor. I get it for some things like being a pilot, like that is something that I should never even consider doing. But I mean, there is like, how do I put this, more educationally based activities that I was also DQ'd from that I essentially just went no, or that I mean, I couldn't go through basic because of type 1 diabetes, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Or it was something like, it was either I couldn't go through it, or I couldn't attain a certain rank, like I was capped out because of the condition. So I know what you're talking about. I've looked into it myself quite a bit.
Yeah, it can get silly sometimes, but at the end of the day, you know, they have certain quotas that they want people to meet, and every single you can get waivers for things, but every single condition they write off as that's okay is something that possibly, even if it's a small chance, could flare up. And then all the time they've taken to train you and develop you as a leader and an airman, that kind of gets thrown out the window, and they really don't want that to happen. So they're like, okay, well, we'll just not let people in that, you know, experience those things. And they've gotten better about it. The waiver process has gotten a little bit easier. I myself am going through the waiver process right now. So it's just a lot of paperwork. And for young people like myself, it's really intimidating. But that's probably the hardest part, really, I'd say, about ROTC is the paperwork. So.
Really?
Yeah,
I have a couple of residents on my floor, and they say the hardest part about ROTC is the actual schedule, you know, dealing with traveling to Marquette and back within the day. The classes themselves.
Yeah, it's a lot about time management as well. It's difficult because you have PT, and then you might have an 8 a.m. class, and you got to rush right to there, and then you're in your PT gear, and people are looking at you like you're weird, like, why are you dressed in a tracksuit? It's the middle of winter. I get those looks a lot. it's difficult because you have these responsibilities outside of class you have to deal with. You know, you need to know certain things, like warrior knowledge is what they call it. And it's a lot about discipline is what they're trying to instill in you when it comes to that time management aspect. A lot of the cadre, or the actual officers that are in charge of the cadets that run the detachment, they want to see you do well, but they're really trying to figure out who really wants this bad enough, because the Air Force has been really lowering selection rates for officers recently. They've gone down from, like, I think in the 2000s they were at like 90% or something of all people who did ROTC and had decent GPAs got in, and now it's like 45%. Because with COVID happening, no one wants to leave because they're scared of unemployment. So it's kind of in a stalemate at the moment.
Do you have any numbers for if ROTC or just military enrollment in general has increased or decreased because of COVID? Do you know anything about that?
I don't have any numbers, but I'd assume that with everything that's gone on in Afghanistan, not going to make a comment on whether the policy was right or wrong. I'm just going to say that I feel like a lot of people in the American public are have very mixed feelings about that. And so support for the military has kind of dropped now. That's what I feel would be the more deciding factor. I don't think it would be COVID that would lower the enlistment rates for it. It would be something more political like that, or socioeconomic factors.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We got a little off track there from developmental projects, so let's rotate back to that.
Oh, yes, of course.
So you were talking about your love for basically the Iron Man suit as a child. Like, that you know of, a real project has kind of entertained the same amount of enthusiasm that you know of? Something that really you think is cool and that you wish you worked on? I mean, you probably only know declassified stuff, but still.
Yeah, so I feel like in terms of the physical projects, there are lots of like cyber warfare projects I love, but one big one is this is a U.S. Navy project at the moment, the railgun system that that DARPA was trying to work on, which is kind of like the research branch of the Department of Defense. That was a really cool project. They got a projectile to go like Mach 7 or something without using any gunpowder, you know, all electricity, which I'm big on, pure electric power. I love Tesla and whatnot. So I love that project, but they kind of defunded it because the big issue with railguns is that when you're sliding a projectile along electromagnetic rails, you run into a material science problem because you need something that conducts electricity fast enough for Lorentz force, which is what actually propels the projectile along the barrel. You need something that's conductive, but it's also durable enough to withstand the friction of a bullet traveling Mach 7. And they'd have to replace the rails like every couple of shots, and they couldn't figure out any material to do it with. And so I would love to I'd love to be a part of a team that had another go at that. Because I feel like you don't necessarily need a railgun to achieve that kind of speed. I don't think there's been any attempt at coil gun technology, which doesn't require any contact with any electromagnets or anything. It kind of just hovers in the center. It's like a bunch of solenoids in series, and you activate them and it slowly speeds up the bullet more and more. So
that's very space intensive. I've looked into coil gun technologies a bit.
Yeah, the handheld ones that people make are awesome.
The problem is then again, you have to think about the military technology again and also consider the economic issue at that point, because to get the inductors and capacitors needed to make a coil gun that even holds up to, what I'm basically trying to say is I don't think it's cost effective to mass produce coil guns at the moment, at least, compared to just, you know, mass producing guns like we can already do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Coil guns aren't very efficient whatsoever. Even if you add a bunch of electromagnets and have like a mile long barrel, it's still not very effective. It is an alternative, but it's hard because you also run into a physics problem where you have, you know, as you make the barrel longer and longer, you get those decreasing returns. And yeah, it's going to be a really long time, at least I think with my limited knowledge, before we see something like an electric powered weapon that can launch projectiles effectively.
I don't know about that. I mean, if you consider the evolution of warfare, it's been shockingly fast in the past two centuries.
Well, yeah, but I feel like a lot of the funding that's being dumped into DoD projects right now is more focused on the cybersecurity aspect, because that's where we're really struggling the most. And so, like, I feel like the U.S. Navy could have made the railgun work, but they just didn't want to dump more money into it when they already had hypersonic missile technology in development. And it just wasn't worth it for them to make that specific thing, even though they probably could have.
Let's see. So getting on, I think it would be good to explain the cybersecurity cyber warfare in general, and in specific its development in the United States. Do you know about it?
I know of different stories. A lot of it is shrouded in mystery just because it's such a sensitive topic, but one of my favorite projects that involved that, if you know about the story behind Stuxnet, Stuxnet is a class A act by just, it just went perfectly. Do you know about Stuxnet?
A little. I'm vaguely familiar, but please explain.
So in the, well, so this goes all the way back to like the 2000s, right? When we were in the Middle East and we were trying to halt Iran's nuclear program. So I think it was, I can't believe I don't know who was president during that time. I think it was Bush. It was Bush. Bush basically is like, okay, so we don't want Iran to get weapons of mass destruction, and we think that the uranium that the, I think it's the UN was providing them, that they're using it nefariously, because the it was some governing body, I'm pretty sure it was the UN, that's like, hey, we want Iran to have a sustainable nuclear power program, and we want to funnel more money into making that nation more developed. So we need to give them the infrastructure that they need to power their homes, do all these other things. So we'll give them uranium. And they thought that that was a great idea. So the Central Intelligence Agency suspected for a while that they were not using all the uranium to funnel nuclear power development. And so they started Operation Olympic Games. But we didn't want to go to war with Iran, because that would obviously be terrible for our nation. So how can we do this discreetly and halt the production of that enriched uranium, which might go into nuclear weapons? So the NSA goes to Bush, they propose this plan, and they're like, hey, Mr. President, we can launch a virus to basically destroy the entire uranium enrichment facility, which they used centrifuges to enrich the uranium, and they spun really fast. They were like really massive industrial grade centrifuges. So the goal was to implant a worm that would make the centrifuges spin out of control and destroy the facility without firing a single bullet. And they got the virus into the facility because they figured out, they were monitoring the scientists that worked at the facility, and they're like, this guy really has terrible cybersecurity practices. Like, there was one engineer that was just awful. He went on, like, really suspicious websites. He, like, you know, his password was, like, password 123 or something. It was, like, comically bad. And so they implanted the worm, I think, on like an email that he sent or like a website that he went to. And then they got the virus in. And the cool thing about Stuxnet, it was developed by the NSA. And to this day, people still can't really understand the code behind it. It's like magic. I think like parts of it are on GitHub that people have like decompiled.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a monster. It was in development, I think, for like 5 years or something crazy. It first was found in 2010 because the virus was so powerful that it started infecting like 2/3 of all computers in the United States. But it was so well made that it didn't activate unless it knew that it was inside the programmable logic controller inside that specific facility in Iran. So the virus could basically check to see what kind of system it's in, what location it's in, and what facility it's like the control system is controlling. And then it would only activate if it knew that it was in that specific PLC. So, but like pretty much every computer nowadays has Stuxnet hiding on it somewhere. And it's just insane. It was like the first use of cyber warfare in like US history that went really well. And yeah, it worked out, you know, the program was halted for, I think like several years. So that's like the big one that a lot of people know about that got unclassified. Israel also worked on it. Israel's got all kinds of crazy cybersecurity projects they do.
And once Stuxnet was discovered, do you think, did Iran try to get rid of it? Like, what happened after that, you know?
So there is the software infection, the PLC infection, and afterwards it was removed. So the whole company that makes the programmable logic controllers is Siemens. Mm-hmm. I think MSOE uses some of their control systems
yes,
as well.
We
and so they released, like the whole company had to be like, we have to release a bug detection and removal tool for Stuxnet because it started to infect like US PLCs and it would start slowing them down. It wouldn't like cause them to malfunction. It would just kind of be like bloatware. Know what happens like in the aftermath. That there is a statement released by like the news agency of Iran, like their state sponsored news agency. And they knew that the US did it. Like Iran was aware of the fact that there was United States meddling. But since they couldn't directly do anything about it, they never declared war. But they were aware that the fact that, like, the CIA was behind the whole thing. It was in 2010 that they, like, first figured it out. I can't remember when it was deployed. I don't even think there's data on, like, when it officially destroyed the facility.
So, do you think the U.S. government got... I doubt they did, but... How soon do you think Siemens knew about Stuxnet compared to the world? Like, do you think the U.S. government told them, or do you think they had corporate spies within Siemens to essentially implant it from day one?
I don't even know if Stuxnet was meant. I don't think the U.S. government meant for Stuxnet to infect so many machines. It just kind of happened as a result of the behavior of the virus. It is a worm, so it's designed to spread as fast as possible and remain dormant. So it was kind of expected that it would happen, but it wasn't like we want to infect as many machines as possible. They just wanted to get the job done, and that was the best hammer that fit the nail, I guess. So in terms of how Siemens knew, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that like, a government agent just notified them like, hey, this is what's going on. I don't know. I'd have to do more research on it, but.
So as we're getting close to 7 o'clock, which is our normal break time, I want to ask anyone in chat or listening on the radio if they have any questions for Mr. Matt. It appears we do not. So with that, we're going to go on break until 7 o'clock. This has been WJEV Radio 101.1 FM, and this has been Smooth Sailing with Matt Kay as the guest. We'll see you back in a bit.
So I said, sir, can I play something for you? Something special that you'd like to hear. When he looked up at me, he was smiling. Oh, but his eyes couldn't hide the tears. He said, play me the waltz of the angels, and I'll close my eyes and pretend. Play me the waltz of the angels, so I can dance with my angel again. Song I remember, that's the one that she loved the best. It was playing the night that I met her, and it was playing when we laid her to rest. Play me the waltz of the angels, and I'll close my eyes and pretend. Play me the waltz of the angels, so I can dance with my angel again. Let me dance with my angel again. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Smooth Sailing on WJEB Radio 101.1 FM. I am here with Matt Kay. Matt, are you back?
Yes, sir.
And we are talking about ROTC Special Projects. Sorry, not ROTC Special Projects, Department of Defense Special Projects. Matt is part of the Air Force Division of the ROTC program that spans the nation. And we are going to transition now into something Matt said a bit earlier, which is his fascination for the Space Force, where he ultimately wants to end up. So, Matt, what can you tell me about the establishment of the Space Force? Because I know it officially on paper, it's only been around for, I want to say, 2017, but I imagine it's been, you know, stirring around, if you get what I'm saying, for a bit longer than that.
Yeah, of course. So, yeah, the Space Force was created during the Trump presidency. And that was, it wasn't just Trump that had to do with it. It was the joint force for a while, or the entire military as a whole, have been kind of recognizing that the whole space aspect of warfare was becoming more and more important as we started pouring more money into satellite technology and we started using more GPS location and we started modernizing the military. It was done practically because the Space Force, or the space branch of the U.S. Air Force at the time, had such a vastly different mission. And so that's why it became its own branch, just because it was getting so much bigger and more important. And the other big reason is that I think that the Pentagon realized that space, as we transition into being a multiplanetary species in the future, it's going to become more and more important for us to have a space-related military, because it's just going to be, you know, so vital in the future to maintain that critical area around our planet. And so it was more of a, like, we need to do this before our enemies do this, even though it's not like the Space Force doesn't do a whole lot of like fighting in space. There's no like laser weapons or Star Wars, stuff like that. But it might end up that way in the future. Not necessarily with Star Wars, but that's a little bit ridiculous.
But the potential of perhaps even colonizing other celestial bodies is maybe a future possibility.
Oh, absolutely. With partnerships with SpaceX and everything, we're seeing that a lot with the desire to colonize Mars.
Well, even before that, we've already done some very, very limited mining, and just interplanetary mining might be massive in the future.
Absolutely. There's a lot of resources in space. The first person that can provide water in space without having to grab it from the Earth is going to be pretty much a billionaire, because it's so expensive just to send like a bottle of water up to the ISS. I think it's like $5,000 now.
Mm-hmm. And do you think they could do that by, let's say, you can't pull, you know, You can't just pull water out of thin space, right? You can pull water out of thin air, because at least on Earth. So do you think that would involve maybe, you know, going into the atmosphere of, let's say, a planet and pulling out, you know, hydrogen and oxygen from their atmosphere in order to synthesize water, perhaps, or something of those sorts?
Well, that's a good idea, but for a lot of water, the biggest part is transportation, right? We don't want to have to grab it from Earth and bring it up to the space area. We want to be able to just have the water there, be able to make it there. And so there is water in a lot of other places in our solar system besides ice on it. which, you know, still water, but solid.
Yes.
And so, but back to the more military role of that, because I'm not too knowledgeable on, like, the intricacies. Okay. Yeah, the logistical intricacies of, like, establishing a colony. I think that for the future of space warfare, a lot of people envision, I feel like Star Wars with lasers and whatnot. When in reality, it's probably going to be very anticlimactic in the way that it is. Like even an object the size of a quarter can be weaponized if you put it into orbit, because if something the size of a penny or a quarter hits a satellite, going at the speed it is in the orbit around Earth, it'll just decimate it immediately. And so you don't really need a lot, actually, to destroy things in space. Nothing fancy like a Death Star or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, that's where the whole concept of rod from God comes from.
Yep.
If you know anything about that, which I don't know if you want to explain the idea of God rods really quick.
So the whole Rods from God's program was like an idea that the Pentagon thought of, and they thought that they could have a satellite, or really a network of satellites orbiting Earth that could launch just iron tungsten rods into the Earth, and the kinetic energy of that rod alone would be like equivalent to like a nuclear weapon, like a small tactical nuke. And so they wanted to put a network of these things around the orbit of the Earth so they could basically reach down and smack anyone in the face whenever they wanted. That's pretty much the premise.
They're banned, though.
We can't. Well, there's a whole thing that we can't put weapons in space.
The scary thing is, that's not too hard to do. Anyone could basically do that.
Yeah.
Well, any major country with a space program could do that. Any country that can throw up a satellite could basically do that with just a little bit more work.
Corporation could do it too, like SpaceX.
Yeah, corporation could do it as well. So, yeah, that's a bit scary to think about. But going back, before we get too serious on this, we have a question in chat from Mr. Mitch Hendricks himself. Will there be a Space Force military band as there are for, let's say, the Navy military band?
There is not an official Space Force song yet. I imagine that there probably will be, since every other branch has one. I want to say that the Air Force is trying to make a song for the Space Force, and I guess that would imply that they'd need their own band. I don't know. There have been people who aren't affiliated with the military that have made their own versions of a Space Force anthem, and they're okay. I've seen them online and whatnot, but the Space Force is going through a lot of, like, establishing steps. They're their own separate branch, but they're still getting all their stuff figured out right now. Like, they don't even really know what uniform they want to wear yet. I think their uniforms right now look like a Battlestar Galactica uniform, which I think is kind of humorous, but I think they look cool.
What was the, I don't know if you know this, but before the Space Force, what was the last established military branch? I imagine the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Marines, the Army, I guess the Air Force would be the last made one, if you know what I'm saying, but like, even the Air Force was made almost close to a century ago, now that you think about it.
Yeah, it was founded in 1947.
So, I mean, that's less than a century, but closer to a century than a couple decades at that point.
Yeah.
At this point. So, it's kind of amazing that we're seeing the development of a new branch, like, as we speak.
Yeah, it's really telling of what's probably to come, and the fact that things are moving very quickly.
So, I know that there was something I saw, a story that came up in my feed several years ago, where Russia tried to claim Venus. Do you remember this?
What you're talking about sounds familiar to me. I thought it was just like a meme post. I didn't know that it was a real thing.
It was a real thing, which I don't think anyone's going to take that seriously, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, in global politics, but do you think, how do you think colonization is going to work? Do you think it's going to be commercialized? Like, I really hope for a greater humanity, UN takes over space colonization eventually, but I know that's not going to happen. I know it's too profitable. I know we'll see the U.S. claim land, or maybe we have essentially a second age of imperialism, but for space.
Well, if you want to hear my base take on the whole thing, mm-hmm. I personally think it's going to be mega corporations.
Okay.
Elon Musk, and I don't really like throwing his name out there because everyone talks about him when it comes to space technology, but to be fair, he is the guy that's kind of spearheading the whole thing. He talked about it recently, like, once we put people on Mars, what's the first government? You know, what kind of... We always talk about the STEM-related issues and problems that we face from an engineering standpoint of getting to Mars, but, like... what do we do once we get there? And now it's a whole different beast, right? Because it's a social science. And he said that it would probably be best for a direct democracy. No representative democracies, because those are subject to, you know, political intrigue and corruption and whatnot. And it would make more sense because you don't have that many people there. Why would you need a representative democracy? I do think corporations are mainly going to be the one that are spearheading the efforts. Like, NASA is outsourcing all their stuff to SpaceX because SpaceX can do it cheaper and they don't want to spend the money. And I'm happy that we're just getting into space at all. I wish it would be with governments cooperating with each other. I wish that war wasn't a thing at all and that we could all just work towards that, you know, in a perfect world, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that it's not terrible that companies are doing it. It would just be more wholesome, I guess, if nations just decided, hey, we should set aside our differences and do this together. But I think it's probably going to be something like SpaceX that gets the first person to Mars.
Mm-hmm. This is quite a bit of a weird reference, but do you know about the meme where it's like, I'm going to the one place uncorrupted by capitalism.
Base.
Yes.
I do remember that from, that was from a strategy game, wasn't it?
Red Alert 3.
Yeah, Red Alert 3. That's a good game.
I think it's, personally, I think it's, as much as I would like and I do agree, a direct democracy would make more sense than a representational democracy. But that's even considering, like, how do you even... Oh, we have to go to commercial real quick.
All right.
Yeah.
Right.
I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. Say for if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
And we are back on WJEV Radio 101.1 FM. This is Smooth Sailing, and I'm here with Matt Kay. And you were just listening to Folsom Prison Blues by Johnny Cash. So, when we last left off, we were talking about the one place uncorrupted by capitalism, base, and how it is potentially going to be colonized in the future. But before that, we were talking about the Space Force and how it is developing. So let's get back to that. And specifically, I wanted to ask you, what would you like ideally to be positioned in the Space Force as if you do get, I don't know if the word's accepted into the Space Force. I suppose that would be my actual first question. How does one join the Space Force?
So when the Space Force was first established, they took the joint force and transitioned a portion of them into the military. So you actually had some people from the Marines, some people from the Navy going in, but the vast majority of them were from the Air Force. And just until recently, the Space Force was pretty much the best bet you had to get in was you went Air Force, because that's the parent branch of the Space Force, and it just made more sense. And most people in the Air Force are more technologically specialized in for, you know, communications and all those things that you need to know to be in the Space Force. But it recently they did open up enlistment, like direct enlistment in. So it's still hard. You can't just go into any recruiter's office and say, I want to go Space Force. But it is possible now. They released a social media post of their first recruits taking their oaths of service with their hands in the air and everything. So it is possible. But if you want to go officer, which is the ROTC route, usually you put down on your wish list, because an ROTC, ultimately, it's not actually up to you what job you get, which that's a significant risk when you go into any branch of the military, is you might get put in a place you don't want, but you can suggest, like, hey, Air Force, this is where I'd like to go. Here are my top five picks, and then they'll make the decision from there. So, but you can request to go Space Force in your pick. It's usually called Space Operations Officer, I think is like the official career name.
So, is it, okay, do you see potentially in the future, once the Space Force does become larger, it will transition into a system much more similar to, let's say you wanted to join the Coast Guard, you could just specifically choose the Coast Guard and Coast Guard specific positions rather than, you know, having to go through the Air Force and choosing positions that might lead to the Space Force or be in the Space Force itself. And how do you think that would develop over time?
So I'd be very surprised if Space Force, like, so there's two different ways you could get into the Space Force. You can either go the enlisted route, and this is for any military branch. You can either go enlisted route or you can go officer. Enlisted is, you don't have a college degree. Usually you're right out of high school and you just decide to sign up, and then they put you through training and then you're in your job after you pass basic military training. For officer route, I don't really see a Space Force ROTC becoming a thing, mainly because the Space Force is still smaller than the Air Force. And like with the Navy, what I was talking about earlier in the podcast, the Marines are their own branch, but in order to become a Marine, you have to go through Navy ROTC in order to become a Marine officer. And so, and the Marines have been around for quite a long time, and they're a pretty big branch, but they still haven't gotten their own specific ROTC program. So I don't envision the Space Force would get one, but like I said earlier, the Space Force does accept direct enlistments now. I've never looked at going enlisted before, so I don't know the intricacies behind that. However, like I said, they have started accepting like direct admissions in. I just don't know if they offer it everywhere now, like at every recruiting office.
And when you say recruiting office, that kind of brings up an interesting point. Where is the Space Force primarily stationed on Earth right now?
So they have, there are two different MAGE comms or major commands for space. I think there's actually three, but that there's one of them is more logistical. There is a Space Force base in Los Angeles Air Force Base. It's kind of weird because it's a Space Force base and Air Force Base. A lot of them are like that. Like they have double, they like have a double base in the same spot. And then the other one is in Colorado. I do not remember the city name. If any of my fellow cadets are listening to this, they're probably going to be disappointed in me because we have to memorize all the all the MAGECOM base names, but I don't know the city name off the top of my head. But a lot of the big Air Force bases are based in Colorado. That's also where the Air Force Academy is. That's like its own college. I don't know if you know all about the academy.
I know about two of the academies. Well, three technically. But yeah, I've heard of the academies before. But would you like to take a brief, like, short tangent to explain what the academies are? Like,
yeah, of course. So there's a bunch of different ways. I've been talking about ROTC this whole time because this is the only way that I know or I am, like, going through to become an officer, but there's three ways you can actually become an officer in the Air Force. You can go Air Force Academy, which is extremely hard to get into, but
yes,
very prestigious, like, insanely hard to get into. You need a direct...
The Navy's harder, right?
I have no idea. I didn't go for Navy. I tried getting into the Academy, and then I literally saw all the things you had to do, and I kind of lost hope. So I was like, oh, I'll just go ROTC then, because that felt easier to me, and I would still end up in the same spot. So I'm like, hey, I don't know about the Navy, but there's the Academy. So you have to get a congressional nomination from it, like a senator or a congressperson. Usually the congressperson whose district you live in. So mine would have been Gwen Moore, who is congressional district 4 for Wisconsin, I think. It's either 4 or 5. But I never went into interview for her just because I decided not to go academy. So academy is very hard to get into, lots of steps. You can go ROTC, that is, you become a normal college student, but you do military training on the side, and if everything works out, you become an officer when you get your degree. And then the last one is OTS. OTS is kind of weird, officer training school. That's like, it's kind of like the black sheep of all of them, because OTS people are civilians who got their college degree and after college realized, hey, I want to join the military. And so it's too late for them to do ROTC, but they still have their degree. So they kind of just go to like officer training school, and then they just go straight into what they want to do. But OTS is also very hard to get into from what I've heard. Our operations flight commander, he went through officer training school. So.
And I imagine officer training school is just as rigorous as ROTC, if not more rigorous.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've heard that it's even worse because they cram all of that 4 years of instruction ROTC down into, like, maybe I think it's like half a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's rough.
It's intense.
I can't even imagine that. Like, just the sheer, like, and also the background checks you must have to go through, like, after, like, getting a college degree, because you probably have work experience
Oh, absolutely.
That you need to, like, get clear that you're not, I don't know, working for someone else at that point. Like, it must be so much harder with background checks as well.
They don't, they do a background check on you, but the hard part is getting your security clearance. So every officer in the Air Force, at least, don't know about the other branches, but we all have to have, at the very least, a secret security clearance. And getting a security clearance is, like, one of the most, like, it makes you want to rip your hair out because there's so many steps you got to go through. They practically sneak into your house. This is an exaggeration, by the way, but it feels like they like have an hourglass or an eyeglass on you all the time. So
it's crazy. When did you have to do this?
I haven't had to do it yet. I still am just patiently waiting for my time to come when I have to. So,
and when is the time where that's usually done? Like, will it be while you're at MSOE that they're going to essentially hard inspect you?
Not sure on that. I have talked to the upperclassmen cadets, and they've never talked about the process to me. Mm-hmm. So that makes me want to say that they haven't gone through it either, because after you graduate and you commission, which is like you take your oath and everything and you're in, right? You go inactive reserves for a period of time and then you wait to get your assignment. So you're legit like just unemployed for like a solid couple months. And then the Air Force is like, report to this base, and then you fly out, and then you go to your, like, specific training school. So it happens sometime between you getting that letter to go off to your specific area, and, like, I feel like, I don't know. That is a really good question. I'd have to ask someone about that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, we got off track again from the Space Force.
Oh, yeah, that's so good.
As an ROTC officer, way back in the program, you mentioned that they often take supervisor positions with company. Do you know if the Space Force officers have engineering supervisor positions in companies like SpaceX, for example?
Yeah, SpaceX collaborates, like, very distinctly with the government. And since that is the domain of the Space Force, they also work with NASA a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if they would work with a company directly like JPL. Well, that's not really a company. That's more of a division. But if they work with JPL or SpaceX or there's another one called United Launch Alliance or ULA, which is like a collection of companies that group together their aerospace divisions and like made a merger-esque company that just does rockets. So, but yeah, a lot of the details on career-specific things is very fuzzy because the Air Force really does not like to tell us about, like, the details. So,
I imagine so. Do you know of any projects currently being worked on by the Space Force at all, or is it all classified?
Yes, I do. So there is a big problem right now with debris in space. If we keep polluting space with space debris, because whenever we go through stages on rockets, we pretty much just leave junk behind in orbit. And that creates a giant cloud. If you've ever seen the movie WALL-E, it's kind of like that, where like it's covered, the Earth is covered in satellites, and it's almost impossible to get a rocket out of Earth orbit because things will just crash into it because they're going, you know, thousands of miles per hour around the Earth. So the Space Force is trying to eliminate a lot of that right now because that's like one of the biggest perils to putting things in space is like I said earlier, something the size of a quarter hitting a satellite will just like evaporate it. It's that powerful. So they want to capture the garbage and bring it back down to Earth somehow.
How do they plan to, if you know?
I have no idea. I feel like nets. I don't know. I can talk more about ROTC life a little bit more. I can tell you more about that than like I don't know, classified things because they don't tell me anything.
Yeah, they don't. You don't even know yet. But yeah, go ahead. Yeah, what's it like? Because MSOE is a very intense school already. What's the stress level like? What's the day-to-day stress that you're essentially put under?
Well, the worst part is, so I have a student job as well. And that, along with ROTC and classes, basically makes it so I don't have friends. And I'm a commuter student. So that's all just one nice little ball of happiness. And I'm going to be honest with you. Most of my college friends, I'd say like about maybe 70% of them are at Marquette just because they're fellow cadets and I see them on a regular basis, which I love them very deeply. If any of them are watching this, love you. So that's a big challenge, is like you kind of feel disconnected from campus a lot because you're always doing other things and you go to Marquette. So it's very hard to make friends at MSOE. And MSOE isn't a super social school to begin with, even though there are good things to do around campus. So
it's a very small school as well compared to Marquette.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very intense being on Marquette campus. It's like, where am I? And another big challenge is you need to focus on not just the mental aspect, but the physical aspect. You know, you got to get ready for the physical fitness tests that we have to go through, and those are a deciding factor on your class ranking. So you can't just, you know, you can't just min-max and go like, oh, I'm going to get a 4.0 this year. It's like, no, you gotta bust out those push-ups as well. So
as an ROTC member with a lot of friends at Marquette, how do I best put this? Do you spend a lot of time at Marquette? Like, do you stay and, let's say, do homework or, I don't know, break out doing push-ups, like you said, at Marquette rather than MSOE, just because, you know, you have more people around you there doing similar things?
I don't have a lot of chances where I really stay at Marquette. I go there a lot because we have class. And when I say a lot, I just mean, like, more on a regular basis. I'd say I go to Marquette, like, probably at least once a week, but more because I'll need to come talk to other cadets or visit the detachment to ask a question or something like that. And so I'm friends with them, but I don't really stay on campus a lot. And most of the things that we do are like on the weekends, you know, we'll have a detachment social or a squadron social. And, you know, we had a Halloween party this year, or technically last year now. So it's stuff like that. We haven't done a lot of social events recently because we're waiting until classes resume for Marquette to actually start doing stuff. So I get a nice little period of rest before we go back to the normal things. But I don't stay on campus a lot. I'm just there on a regular basis.
And what's it like being a commuter? Just asking in general.
Can I be 100% honest with you?
Yeah.
It's the most awful thing ever. I hate it. Don't ever become a commuter. If any of you are listening to this and you're like, man, I hate the residence halls, I'm going to go get my own apartment far away from campus so I can be away from everybody, don't do it. You're going to die. It's not good. And it also kind of depends on the kind of person you are. I consider myself a very social person. If I don't have human contact, I'll just sort of shut down after a while. I know a lot of people at MSOE aren't like that. and that's fine, but that's just my experiences. I don't really like the commuter life. So I might move in on campus next year. I have no idea.
I would see. Okay, next, I would tell you one thing about moving in next year. It's going to be very, cramped next year, and even a slightly off-campus apartment or building is better than probably something on campus that you can find. And usually, I don't know if you can get some sort of exemption form, to allow you to live just in an apartment building off complex as soon as sophomore year.
Yeah, I have heard of that before. It's I've never really been inside a residence hall before, which is kind of weird, you know, to think about. But I feel like I would like it just because of the social aspect, even if it is cramped. I can cohabitate with people pretty well, but yeah. I've heard bad things about residence halls, but I think it's really just like the social aspect is the most important to me. And since I've never experienced it before, maybe you are right. Maybe it is a bad idea, but I'll do more research on it and get back to you.
Mm-hmm. And as if you did not know, Mr. Mitch Hendricks in the chat was the president of the Residence Housing Association on campus for quite a bit. And he is right in saying that since you are in commuter space, you automatically do have the ability just to live in an apartment because they won't check if you're actually living where you currently are commuting from or not.
Oh, yeah, that's
awesome. Yeah, that's awesome information. But where do you commute from? I don't know if you've already told us or not. I might have just forgotten.
I am based out of River West, which is Hippieville of Wisconsin, or of Milwaukee. It's about a 10-minute drive for me to get to campus.
I wouldn't think 10 minutes would, I guess it's the social aspect of what 10 minutes can mean, though.
Well, it's also because you're not around people consistently.
Yeah.
A lot of people are close with their roommate or, like, with their floor, I feel, because, you know, you're living together. And that's the real kicker, is if you're not actually living around other people. You just kind of show up every day, go to your classes, go to your student job, and then go home because you need to eat dinner.
How do you feel about your student job? Do you like it? I'm currently working a student job as we speak.
I like it because there's a lot of downtime. When you think student job, you're like, oh, God, I have to sacrifice 3 hours of my life every day that I could be doing homework or chilling. And you can kind of mix it in there. I don't love it. But I work in EECS Tech Center, so if you ever see some disgruntled person at the counter when you ring that dreaded buzzer, it's probably me. I have blonde hair, I wear a mask, and I'm 5'7", if that is a good enough describer for you to recognize me. Yeah, EECS Tech Center is all right. I was not working today. It's relatively chill. There's lots of downtime, unless there's like 5 labs going on, and then I have everyone asking me for an analog discovery too.
So, personal question, and now I think we're completely off track, which is usually where we get at this point. Do they actually hunt people down to get analog discovery 2s like during the quarter? Because I've heard mixed reports on that.
So, I am not a headhunter. I am probably the chillest out of all the EECS workers. Like, if you come to me and you want an extended checkout or something, I'm like, if it's something small, I literally don't care. They're like, do I need to bring my professor's signature? I'm like, bro, it's okay. By the way, off the record, MSOE, if you're watching this, I'm a good employee. I promise, don't fire me. No, I don't ever chase anyone down for anything. That's more of like the, I was about to say adult techs. I just realized I'm an adult too. Oops. that's more of like the tech techs, like the guys that are actually employed by the school, and that's like their job. They're not a student. They usually do that. We have 2 of them, Marty and Jim. Shout out to them. They're actually pretty cool guys. They're the ones that'll email you about it, but we just kind of work the front counter. Yeah, I feel like Jim would be the one to bother you about it.
So, I love Jim. I love Jim.
Yeah, Jim's a treasure.
What made you choose EECS tech support? anything.
On my resume for a job. That's literally the only reason.
I see. I am, the only word I can put down is dispatcher, which is still a pretty good word.
It's fancy, yeah.
I work the shuttle, essentially. Oh, and, oh crap, I'm having technical difficulties. Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, you're coming through fine.
Okay, we may have to end slightly early today.
It's all good if we gotta end early.
So, in case you've been listening, I just want to say thank you for coming on tonight. This has been an excellent episode of Smooth Sailing.
Of course, it was a pleasure to be here. Glad to talk to you about everything.
And for everyone else that's listening in or wants to listen into the future, you can find all of our episodes on WJEB's official site and just click on the Smooth Sailing link to get access to our records of this episode. And thank you for listening, everyone. This has been Smooth Sailing, and I hope your night is smooth. Okay, everyone. Goodbye.
See ya.
Come on and sing my song.